Okay, good afternoon, everybody. 12:43, Tuesday, May 11th, and we're doing Chem 12B lecture. Oh my God, we're down to the last two lectures. This is crazy. I don't even know exactly what to do. We want to finish out the chapter that we're in, which is chapter 19, looking at acetals and ketals and hemiacetals and hemiketals. And their related compounds. So I want to show you some of the related compounds really quickly. This afternoon in lab, as we did this morning in lab, we'll go through more of these mechanisms and do a bunch of practice problems. And I did a good session this morning. I think that we will repeat that this afternoon so you get more practice with it. So you see these mechanisms a little bit more. But let me go ahead and start a screen share. We'll jump into kind of where we left off. And I will sort out my note scrambled issue. So what we had been looking at, and I can't quite see the spaces now. I've got there. BB, when will co-op number 4 be due? You know what I was playing with doing with co-op number 4 is we all did it together. And because we all did it together already and sort of went through all the answers, I was just going to give everybody the points for it, throw everybody the points at it. So I don't think there's any point in having you. I mean, it's good to go through and do it for practice, to do it on your own again, to repeat it and to look at those answers and to go through and do that. But the answers are out there. And we did it together in terms of doing it together in the lab session. And so, yeah, I was just going to throw the points on it. That was my game plan. Okay. Is Thursday going to be exam review from JC or more new material? I have not decided. Usually I don't throw a whole lot more material at you. And we can talk about what I envision that exam looking like. And I also take a little bit of time and talk about transitioning, you guys graduating, moving on, going to the different colleges, different universities, and what to expect, how to get into research groups, all those little sort of parting words that I like to do before you guys take off. See, you're almost going to get me talking about it now instead of actually doing what I'm supposed to do. There's just a lot as you move from community college to the university, and there's a lot of anxiety and apprehension and some of it is good and well-placed, and some of it is just a transition and being new. And so I like to talk a lot about those transitions, having done that myself, having transitioned from Cabrillo to a four-year university, and not having a lab. How do you find that lab experience? How do you get into a lab? It's going to be hard to say what is the expectation moving forward as you go into higher level classes and have to do lab work. The instructors are going to have to realize that you haven't had lab before, and so they're going to know that. They're going to have to adjust to their expectations and their teaching and what they're going to teach you and expect from you. But also you guys are going to have to be self-advocates, and you're going to have to stand up and say, hey, you know, it was COVID. We didn't have this yet. Can you explain this to more detail? Can you demonstrate? Can you show it? Don't be afraid to ask questions and don't move forward when you have safety concerns or concerns about how to do some aspect of the lab. And I think that you'll find that the instructors are going to be receptive to that, that they're going to understand those limitations and that they're going to have to do some remediation in terms of the actual lab work. So lots to talk about in those transitions. And depending on where you're going, those transitions are going to be different for each. You know, if you're going to Berkeley, it has a very different sort of environment than if you're going to San Jose State versus a Davis or any of those other schools or UCSC. They all have their own individual culture. And while I wasn't a student, you know, at all of those, I've had enough experience from people that have gone to those different schools to know the culture of those different schools. And so it's kind of fun to talk about those different cultures and environments and what to expect. So we'll probably talk a lot about that on Thursday as well. That's kind of a cool thing to talk about. All right. So what we've been spending time on is mainly looking at, it is frozen. Interesting. It didn't freeze on me once this morning. And the first thing that I try to write, and it's frozen. Okay, better. So what we've been looking at is taking alcohols, be it two equivalents, although we don't generally write the two equivalents, it's usually implied, and something like ETOH, PTSA, or TSOH is the other way that that can be abbreviated, Dean Stark. So you can see a Dean Stark trap. And these go to either making, in this case, the ketal, or we could put in here in parentheses that you could have a hydrogen in this location in which it could be an acetal. And the other possibility is taking these guys and reacting them with diols. And same sort of conditions, PTSA, Dean Stark, toluene as a solvent is oftentimes included in there. And these make the cyclic cyclic ketal. Or possibly acetal. And those are the mechanisms that we've been going over. And these are both for functional groups, for functional group modification, swapping between functional groups. We see it in the sugar chemistry and also as protecting groups, particularly the cyclic ones. They can both be used as protecting groups, but oftentimes we see that the cyclic acetals and ketals are used more frequently because they're more robust for protecting groups. More robust meaning harder to cleave. And therefore used as protecting groups. And just as a demonstration of how we might use those as a protecting group to go through and do something, we can take something that has carbonyls, but different types of carbonyls. So we have an ester and we have a ketone. And let's maybe even just make it a specific. Let's just leave that as a methyl ester, that we can take this and react it first with the diol, PTSA. Now we can write Dean Stark sometimes. Sometimes we don't always write Dean Stark, but you should recognize those reaction conditions, diol and acid, PTSA, that would go and form the ketal, in this case, on the ketone, and leave the ester unreacted. Now, why does the ester remain unreacted? That goes to the reactivity of carbonyl compounds, that when we look at carbonyl compounds, their reactivities are such that aldehydes are much more reactive than our ketones, which are much more reactive than esters. And those are more reactive than carboxylic acid. And that guy's a whole lot more reactive than a carboxylate. So this is the order of reactivity being more reactive. And that usually allows us to be able to select and to work with the ketone in the presence. There you guys are. Just getting my windows move around here for a second. That allows us to be able to work with an aldehyde or a ketone in the presence of an ester and not react the ester. It's harder to try to put some sort of protecting group on top of the ester. So we can do that, and then we can take and we can do some reaction to the ester that we might have done. So two equivalents of CH3MgBr, two equivalents of Grignard, and then dilute acid. This does our ester reaction, where we convert the ester into a tertiary alcohol. So the group here is adding twice to the ester. And then finally, we would go through and we would remove the protecting group. And we would do that with conditions that would use water and acid, usually some heat, in order to remove that. And take it back to the ketone. So there's just a small example of how we would do that. All right, so along with these guys, where we're looking at alcohol nucleophiles, one of the things that we also introduced was nitrogen nucleophiles, or said that we were going to talk about nitrogen nucleophiles, but we hadn't really done it yet. So let's look at the commonality of these reaction mechanisms and how nitrogens can act as nucleophiles. With carbonyl compounds. So let's take benzaldehyde as an example and react it with a primary amine. Let's do something simple, CH3NH2. And same sort of conditions, PTSA and Dean Stark. And what this creates is, in this case, it creates an imine. Notice that it's sort of like the nitrogen equivalent of a carbonyl. The nitrogen has replaced the oxygen and has the double bond to the carbon, much the same way that the oxygen was doing. And the mechanism for its formation is right in the wheelhouse of the acetal-ketal sort of mechanism. So it all runs exactly the same way. If you look at it, it's acid-catalyzed, and it's acid-catalyzed, that means that we're going to do a protonation first off, and then the mechanism is almost absolutely the same. So you take that ketone, protonate it with the acid. The protonation activates the carbonyl for nucleophilic attack, makes it a much stronger partial positive on the carbonyl carbon. The nitrogen comes in and does that nucleophilic attack, opening up the carbonyl exactly the same way as we did with the acetals and ketals. Similarly, the nitrogen also carries the positive charge after addition. And we need to deprotonate that nitrogen using one of the conjugate bases in solution, pulling that proton, giving the electrons back to the nitrogen. Okay, now that we've taken the proton away, that next step was always a shuttling of the proton. Taking the proton and creating a good leaving group out of the group that is supposed to leave. So if we look, take a look at that, our leaving group, or what we want to create as a leaving group, is the OH group. And so we're going to protonate that OH group. And this step, there's generally some question as to why would this oxygen protonate in preference of the nitrogen. The nitrogen is by far the stronger base. And this protonated oxygen has a pKa that is like -1, -2. So why in the world would the nitrogen give up the proton to that oxygen that way? And the answer to that is actually pretty simple. Every one of these are reversible steps. And in that they're reversible steps, there's an equilibrium that's established. And the equilibrium may be far to the right-hand side where the nitrogen actually carries the proton. That may be the most favorable equilibrium position. However, even if a small amount of this is created, once a small amount of this is created in equilibrium, it very rapidly leaves through the assisted leaving step. The lone pairs push in and push that that water molecule out. And once that water molecule is pushed out, this is not so easily reversible, because then the water is removed through the Dean-Stark track. We're removing it physically from the chemical reaction. And as the water is removed, it can't go backwards. So this step here is the irreversible step. And the water leaves the reaction vessel. And the last thing that happens is that acid is regenerated by having a base in solution take the proton. And that's your amine. So the reaction mechanism is almost equivalent. It's got all the same steps, assisted leaving and everything else that happens with that. Okay. So this is making an amine, but we started from something here that was a special type of aldehyde. It was an aldehyde that had an sp2 hybridized carbon that was next to it. If we try to do this reaction mechanism with something that, like acetone, and we use RNH2 and PTSA, Dean Stark, instead of forming the imine, it likes to form an enamine. These are related to an enol. but they're more stable. So enols, we know, spontaneously convert the tautomerize into their ketone form. The tautomerization of an enamine would take it to the imine, but enamines are fairly stable things for the amine. And the way that these form, I'm wondering if I want to do, no, I'm going to change this real quick. Let's do it as an R2. And so the difference here is that this is going to be a primary amine, whereas this guy is a secondary amine. And so that makes this into an R group. Okay, so those were all my changes. Is that we've got two R groups as opposed to one R group. Let me show you why this doesn't go to the imine and rather goes to the enamine for these types of cases. The mechanism is exactly the same as what we did. You start off with a protonation. You activate it. Nice simple structure to keep things easy. We then take the secondary amine and we do the nucleophilic attack. So the reaction mechanism stays the same. The nitrogen has now four things bound to it, two R groups, and the proton. And we go through and we take the proton away, shuttle the proton around, create the good leaving group on the oxygen. So there's our neutral species. Now we're going to give that proton back to the oxygen to create the good leaving group for the oxygen. Okay, that's the good leaving group. Now that I've got a good leaving group, the other thing that happens, or the next thing that happens, is the assisted leaving step, right? So normally what we do is we push the electrons in with the nitrogen, break the bond to the oxygen. This gives us the imine type structure. Okay, so pause here for a second. Look back at the mechanism that was back here for the imine formation. This step right here. When I formed the double bond, after I pushed out, here it was, after I pushed out the oxygen, once the oxygen got pushed out and I had the double bond to the nitrogen, it was an easy thing to go in and deprotonate the nitrogen. And the simple deprotonation left us with the imine. But notice now that there's no proton. I can't deprotonate anything because the nitrogen has no proton to pull. So the only way to alleviate the positive charge on the nitrogen is to take and pull a proton off the carbon. and to push the electrons in and to push the electrons up onto the nitrogen. It's the only way to alleviate the positive charge. And that makes the enamine. So what we find is that when we have, let's do it this way, let's put this in the center. When we have R and H2, PTSA, these will make the imine. So that's a primary. But when we take it and react it with R2NH, PTSA, this is a secondary imine, then the only way to alleviate the positive charge is to form the enamine. And so what product you get depends on whether you're reacting with a primary or a secondary amine. Now, what do you think happens if you try it with a tertiary amine with three R groups? Look back at the reaction mechanism and look at what happens after the addition. Look at what happens right here. Right after we do the first addition, there's a deprotonation. With the primary amine, right after the addition, there's a deprotonation. And so that first step is always deprotonation. But if you have a tertiary amine, is there anything to deprotonate? No. And so what happens is with tertiary amines have no reaction, essentially. Tertiary amines don't go forward and do these types of reactions. These reaction mechanisms, the amine, imine, and enamine, are very similar to other functional groups. And so these mechanisms are absolutely conserved. For instance, you can take a ketone and react it with hydroxylamine. And PTSA. This makes a structure that is very imine-like. The nitrogen is the stronger nucleophile. This is called an oxime. You can take that carbonyl and react it with hydrazine. PTSA. And it makes this type of structure called a hydrazone. And one more. And all these chemistries are related. This thing is, carbazide. And it makes a carbosome. And the mechanisms are absolutely identical for all three of these. And why do we do these different types of things? The oximes, the hydrazones. The hydrazone is how we do the Wolff-Kishner reaction. We'll look at that in just a second. And so the formation of that hydrazone follows the imine formation and is exactly the same mechanism. The oximes, there's other things that we can do with oximes. The carbazones, likewise, we can turn these carbazones into other functional groups, although oftentimes these are derivatives that are made that make a solid compound with a specific melting point and allow us to identify what this compound actually was so that we can use it for the identification of unknowns. And they all work by the exact same mechanism. Let me show you that mechanism of that Wolff-Kishner reaction. We'll remind you what that thing looks like. This is a reduction. And what we do is we take the carbonyl, we react it one, H2 and NH2 in PTSA. Actually, I don't even think they do it. Yeah, maybe they do. This makes this guy, which then they react with base, sodium hydroxide, which liberates that and makes N2 gas that comes off. And so the reaction for that, if we start from a hydrazone, the hydroxide pulls a proton, which pushes electrons in. This guy reaches out and grabs a proton somewhere from the solvent. And so the first thing that winds up happening is we've picked up a proton and we've created a double bond between the nitrogen. So it's just a cascade of electrons of pulling that proton. Electrons push in to make a double bond with the nitrogen, pushing these electrons out, where this now double bond acts as a nucleophile and grabs the proton. Do that one more time. Hydroxide grabs this, pushes electrons in. This bond breaks and reaches out and grabs a proton from solution. And as that happens, the nitrogen fragments off, becomes N2. And you have picked up two protons from the solvent. And that's the Wolff-Kishner. What's really nice about the Wolff-Kishner, as opposed to the Clemmensen reaction, is the Clemmensen uses zinc and mercury. And mercury is just so toxic and hard to get out of things that when you want to do a reduction like this and you're doing it for some sort of medicinal compound or something that you want that compound to have some use other than a chemical use, you want to have some biological use with it, then you don't want to have mercury involved in it. The Wolff-Kishner is an outstanding reaction because it just generates non-toxic products. You're generating, if we look at it, we're generating essentially the hydrocarbon, nitrogen gas, which drives off, and base, sodium hydroxide. So super useful reaction. And then of course, if we take these reactions, these imines and enamines, similar to what we could do with the acetals and ketals, where we treated them with water and acid and some heat, and we could break them off, we could hydrolyze them. We can do the same thing with the imines and the enamines. If you take the imine and you add water and acid and heat, it will hydrolyze and give you back the starting amine. So these reactions are fully reversible. And the same thing with the enamine. And the mechanism for them is just the absolute reverse. And we'll look at those mechanisms today in lab, as we did in the morning lab. So the morning lab, those people looking at these would be able to a little better see the reaction mechanism involved. So they're absolutely fully reversible. Okay, here I need to make a decision. I think what I want to do is, along with these, the Wittig reaction is one that I wanted to show you that's a really important reaction that's in this chapter. And this one requires a little bit more, it's a little bit different in understanding how this reaction takes place. So that is it for those types of reactions. This is a little bit different. The Wittig reaction. The Wittig reaction is a reaction whereby you replace a carbonyl with an alkyl group. Let me show first how we make this reagent. Triphenylphosphine. Has three phenyl groups on the phosphorus. These three aromatic rings help for the solubility of the phosphorus. They make the phosphorus more alkyl-like because they're really nonpolar alkyl groups, aromatic groups that are on that phosphorus. But the phosphorus with the lone pair is still a really good nucleophile. So this is a super organic soluble nucleophile. And what we tend to do is react these with an alkyl group. Usually something like methyl bromide, just an alkyl halide. These guys generally react in an SN2 type reaction where this knocks out the leaving group. And it gives the phosphorus now a positive charge. I'm going to abbreviate the phenyl groups. Just as a pH, rather than writing out the whole phenyl group, so it makes it a whole lot easier for you guys to keep up, if that helps. And the hydrogens now on the carbon. Okay, and the next thing that we do, the other reason that these aromatic rings are here is because when we do make this positive charge, those aromatic rings can help to stabilize that positive charge through resonance. And so they help to delocalize that positive charge and make that positive charge really stable and still soluble so it doesn't just precipitate out. So there's a lot of reasons why those aromatic rings are there. They're not just fluff on the molecule. They're really, really, really important. Okay, then we use a strong base. So the base that we use is usually a potassium tributoxide or an LDA. The base pulls one of the protons, giving the electrons back to the carbon. This thing now is called the Wittig reagent. It's an illid. Illids are molecules that have a positive and negative charge within the molecule. But this illid is really special. This illid is special because generally we don't draw it with the positives and negatives. We draw it with a double bond. In this case, the phosphorus being in period three in the periodic table, being in period three means that it has d orbitals and it can expand its octet, so it can go more than 8 electrons. So if you're looking at it, it's got 2, 4, 6, 8, 10. It's a 10 electron exception for phosphorus, which is totally in phosphorus's wheelhouse to be able to do a 10 electron exception. And in fact, the 12 electron exception as well. So in terms of drawing this, we generally draw it as the neutral species with the 10 electron exception for the phosphorus. However, the way in which it reacts is it reacts as the carbanion. So this is the major resonance contributor. But reacts as a carbon nucleophile. So what we do now in terms of a Wittig reaction is we take a carbonyl and we react this with a carbonyl. Let's do it here. PH3, P, double bond, CH2, DMSO. And what it does is it creates a double bond plus PH3P double bond O. So the pi bond for the P is D overlap with the P on the carbon. Keegan, something like that, yes. What happens is that the phosphorus has an electron or a hybridization, which is not sp3 or sp, well, we would look at it, we would say sp1, p2, p3, we would say sp3 and that it would be tetrahedral in shape, but that doesn't do justice for what it actually is. It's actually hybridized as an sp3d hybridization, where the d orbitals are part of the hybrid system. And so, yes, it's taking part of those d orbitals, combining them to make hybrid orbitals, and it's winding up making making hybrids out of these guys that it's using one of those hybrid orbitals in order to make the double bond. So the double bond is actually still probably an empty p to p double bond, but the d orbitals are thrown in here into the hybridization, and I couldn't even tell you what the picture looks like in terms of that complex bonding pattern. But yes, it's using the p orbitals as part of its hybridization. And it's this little mechanism here of the way that this guy adds that's really interesting. Take the carbonyl and write it this way. Actually, let's keep it as its ILID to demonstrate what happens. The carbanion attacks. This guy opens up. The negative charge acts as a nucleophile and binds to the phosphorus. Again, using the 10 electron exception for phosphorus, phosphorus expands its octet and acts here as an electrophile. We make a constrained four-membered ring system where now the positive charge on the phosphorus is gone. When I took the negative and reacted it with the phosphorus, which was electron deficient and had 1, 2, 3, 4 valence electrons that were being shown, so it had a formal charge, there was a formal positive charge on the phosphorus. Once it makes the bond with the oxygen, it now has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 valence electrons and is now neutral. And it has 2, 4, 6, 8, 10 total electrons back to the 10 electron exception. So phosphorus in this case is making the bond with the oxygen because it's alleviating the positive charge and going to a neutral species. This four-membered ring system entirely collapses in sort of a paracyclic reaction, where I generate the double bond to the CH2 group. And the phosphorus winds up catching the double bond to the oxygen. Phosphorus and oxygen make an extremely strong bond. Phosphorus is very oxophilic. And that's part of the reason that this four-membered ring system collapses in the way that it does and leaves me with the double bond. But what's really cool about this is the flexibility that I have within this reaction. Almost anything that I can take and put onto the carbon here in this position, any R group that I can attach to this, I can make a vitig out of it. And so as long as I can do the SN2 reaction with it, I can make a vitig reagent with it. And it's not as sensitive as Grignard's, which is really cool. So in general, what I can do is I can take PH3P plus R, let's say R and R prime and H. It doesn't work so well with, it doesn't work at all if I can't do the SN2 group and if I don't have to have a hydrogen. So I have to have one hydrogen and I have to have a leaving group. And as long as I can go through and do that and create the vitig reagent, and use that strong base, to pull the proton, then I can make almost any vidic that I want. And then react that with a carbonyl compound. And you can make all kinds of substituted alkenes. Something that would have been really, really helpful for some of those synthesis problems that we had to do where we had the alkenes and no way to get the alkene in the position where we wanted it to be. This also very well tolerates ketones and aldehydes. Tolerates carbonyls, alpha to the vidic. So in other words, I can take and use this guy to be able to go and react with the triphenylphosphine. It'll make this that then I can treat with the base. Pulling that proton and the electrons kick in and it makes, I guess I should swing this arrow down. It makes a vidic reagent and does so successfully. And then I can go ahead and react this with a carbonyl. And it doesn't self-attack. So now if I take this and I react this with a ketone like that, then what I create is the double bond to the carbonyl and that guy. And so it makes an alpha beta unsaturated ketone. And I don't need to protect this. So why don't I need to protect that? What's fascinating about that is the idea of resonance here, that if I consider the resonance associated with a negative charge in this location, that the negative can go this way and be stabilized into the phosphorus with a double bond, but it can also flip this direction and be stabilized this way. Which makes the carbonyl unreactive because the carbonyl is tied up in the resonance and it protects the carbonyl so that it doesn't react internally. It doesn't react with other molecules like itself because the carbonyl isn't really a strong carbonyl. If you have a carbonyl anyplace else in the molecule, then you run into problems. But if it's just alpha to the vidic carbon, it survives just fine. And it allows us to make some really, really cool stuff. Okay, so that's the vidic reagent. And lots that we can do with that vidic reagent. Along with that, this brings up an interesting question then. If a carbonyl can do this, and I can resonate electrons into the carbonyl, then what about this? So this is called an enolate. And enolates are a whole area, a whole chapter that we have. I think it's 1920. I think it's chapter 21, where we look at exclusively enolates and enolate reactions. And they're sort of the next big section. I know that the book goes, after chapter 19, the book goes into carboxylic acids, but carboxylic acids are actually quite boring compared to everything else. Carboxylic acids are acidic and they have their sort of acidic functionality, and they have formation of carboxylic acids, all of which is review. And there's nothing that's really interesting in the carboxylic acids. Trying to see if there's anything, and I don't see anything that I really want to hit. I'm going to stack these up in a different position. Okay. Now I've got notes sorted out. How are we doing? I haven't stopped or paused for a minute. Let you guys catch a breath. Ask any questions. This sort of concludes I believe it's chapter 19 that we were in. Just want to look back real quick. Yeah, chapter 19, aldehydes and ketones. So this concludes chapter 19. Chapter 20 is carboxylic acids. Mostly what's in here are the formation of carboxylic acids. But you guys have already done most of those reactions. Most of those reactions are review. Most of those reactions are things like taking aldehydes and oxidizing them using something like Jones in order to make a carboxylic acid. Or another example would be taking a double bond and splitting it with ozonolysis and an oxidative workup that would give you the carboxylic acid. And of course, the other side of this would translate into formic acid. But other than that, there's a little bit of ester formation, a few other reactions that aren't super interesting in terms of the carboxylic acids. It's really when we get into enolates and what we can do with enolates, which are in chapter 21, which are far more interesting. And I'd like to give you an idea of what these look like and how these work. So to start this off, let me give you this reaction. If we take acetone and react it with Br2, a reaction takes place. You do this in water, 65 degrees. And what you find is that it brominates. About 50%. But then the other 50% is a combination of different products. And part of the question is, where are these products coming from? How do these reactions actually work? So you know that we talked about enol ketol tautomerism. And that the enol is in equilibrium drastically towards, drastically towards the ketone side. But for every ketone and aldehyde, there's a small amount of enol. Turns out that the enols are actually nucleophiles. And that the enol, if we take the enol and look at the reaction with bromine, that the electrons push in and grab the bromine, very similar to ways that double bonds do. It's basically just electrophilic addition to a double bond, except that enols are stronger nucleophiles than most double bonds. This regenerates the carbonyl, and then the bromine here, the bromide, removes the proton, generating HBr as a byproduct. And so what's happening is the enol is acting as a nucleophile. And that's how these substitutions are happening. Keegan, I see the question, will Thursday be a full-on lecture or more of a review? Thursday is going to be a combination of review and talking about transfer, and we'll talk about the exam, we'll talk about review, we'll talk about transferring, we'll talk about a whole bunch of things, but not a whole lot of new material, Keegan. So I'm just kind of finishing up. I just want you to be able to see these enolates and see what happens with these enolates. And so one of the things that we can do here is that if we can take and we can purposefully make this, then maybe we can use it to alkylate things. And that's what we want to do here. We want to take something like this guy and react it with a strong base. Remember this base, NaNH2, sodium amide, strong base. I hear you, JC. I'm trying not to zip through things. I'm trying to introduce it the way that I would normally introduce it without going too fast. We'll see how it goes. The protons that are here, alpha to the carbonyl, These protons are acidic. They have a fairly low pKa. Their pKa is like around 26. If you consider a proton that is just on an aromatic ring system without any carbonyl next to it, these guys are pKa 60. So the difference between 26 and 60 is ginormous. Remember that it's a logarithmic scale that we're looking at. And so what happens is that NH2 base pulls the proton, dumps electrons in, and produces an enolate. In this case, a sodium enolate, because the sodium is the counterion for it. Take that sodium enolate and give it now an electrophile. And the electrons will push in, push out, and kick out the leaving group. And you can make new carbon-carbon bonds. And so the new bond that you've created is there. We had the three carbon chain, and you've now alkylated this. You've created a stereocenter. So we've created plus minus, but we've gotten about a 60% yield, which isn't too bad. So we're able to take and use different bases, amine bases, in order to pull this proton. So the two bases that we tend to use, two main strong bases, are sodium amide and LDA, lithium diisopropyl amide. And the reason that we use those bases as opposed to other things is that their conjugates, NH3, has a pKa, which is right around 40, maybe like 43. And the pKa on diisopropylamine is like 48. So these bases are strong enough to be able to remove that proton that has a pKa of 26 and fully remove it to be able to make the enolate. So that's why we're going for the amine bases. And this allows us to do a number of different types of reactions. Let's see. Oh, I'm hesitant to throw this in there. Let's see what you do with this. Which proton are you going to remove?
The ones on the right.
Why?
Because of Sturix.
Because LDA is big.
Yeah.
I like that. Let's go with that. And then let me add into it methyl iodide. And you create this guy by about 76%. And the other percentage that you get the other small sort of 6% is that guy. So this was a good idea here. LDA is a bulky base. And that bulky base, because of its sterics, chooses to go for the less sterically hindered side, pulling the proton on the less sterically hindered side. Is there any way that I could pull the other proton? If I wanted to make the other thing major.
Do you use NaNH2?
Close.
NaH.
What's that?
Sodium hydride.
Sodium hydride. That's a good idea too. Sodium hydride, not the best base for that. Exactly. Here's the way that this works. Here's a way that we can do it. If you use a base that is a weaker base, sometimes what they'll use is they'll use potassium terbutoxide. To pull this. And what happens with potassium terbutoxide, you say, wait a minute, potassium terbutoxide is a bulky base as well. And it is, it's a bulky base. And so what potassium terbutoxide does is it pulls this proton initially to give you this guy. But that's in equilibrium and goes back and forth. And because it's in equilibrium, and actually the equilibrium dramatically favors the left-hand side. But what winds up happening is over time, as this is going back and forth, this guy can eventually pull the proton on the other side. And eventually what winds up happening is it forms this enolate. Okay, so tell me the difference between these two enolates, this guy and this guy. Which enolate is more stable?
The bottom one.
The bottom one, why?
Because it's quad substituted.
Yeah, because it's more substituted. This is the thermodynamic. And this is the kinetic. And then once we get that thermodynamic enolate, Now I can treat it with methyl iodide and I can make this guy major. Like 80%. There's another way that this is done too, that is just a little bit more subtle, which is really cool. The other way that this is typically done, I'll give you two reactions. Let me do the same reaction so it's easy to draw and easy to see. So we don't have to think about something new. If you take this and react this with 1.2 equivalents of LDA, and then number two, methyl iodide, make this guy. So the difference here is 1.2 equivalents. Take the same one and react it with 0.98 equivalents of LDA and number two, CH3I. And you make that guy. What just happened?
Changing the rate determining step and the concentration.
Not exactly. It's not quite the rate determining step, but you're close. You're on the right track.
I mean, if you decrease the amount, then it would slow it down.
Yes. Yes, that's also on the right track. That's even closer.
Okay, I give up.
No, you were doing great. Okay. When I do 1.2 equivalents, I have more LDA than I need. What this does is this goes very fast through the kinetic enolate. And it all goes through this. But what this one does is this one doesn't have a full equivalent. It's got just a little bit less than it needs, which means that initially 0.98 equivalents of this guy are formed. Plus some of this guy is left over. These guys set up the equilibrium that together can react, one acting as the acid, one acting as the base, and allow it to form the thermodynamic enolate. So these set up the equilibrium. So in essence, when you say slow it down, it does, giving it time for the equilibrium to establish, giving it time to produce the thermodynamic enolate. So basically what's happening is, it's forming the thermodynamic. Because what's critical for forming the thermodynamic is it's critical that I have some of this unreacted material hanging out in there. And that's what's missing up here. This is 100%. no way to go backwards. It's a one-way reaction. And because it's a one-way reaction, it gives me that product. But because this one can get to the thermodynamic, it gives me the thermodynamic product. Just by changing that little tiny bit of concentration, which is a super, super cool outcome. These enolate reactions are extremely versatile. They have all different names for all different types. Some of them are called aldols. Some of them are called aldol condensations. Some of them are called microreactions. Some of them are called Dieckmann condensations and all kinds of things. Basically, all you're doing with all of these is you're looking at pulling a proton alpha to a carbonyl. So there are many different types of carbonyls where you can pull the proton. And it can be next to an ester. It can be next to a ketone. It can be next to an aldehyde. All of these protons are in the sort of 26 pKa range and can be pulled in order to do enolate reactions. Even more so, if you take and put a proton between two carbonyls, now you've taken the pKa of this proton down into the 12 range, and you can pull that proton with sodium hydroxide. And so all of these all go through and allow us to make carbon-carbon bonds by using various bases by pulling the proton very simply. And they all go through the exact same chemical reaction. So there's lots of chemistry here to explore and lots of reactions that are really, really cool to show. And ways in which they react together, aldehydes and ketones to do the aldol condensations and things. We did a little bit of that in lab, and I'm not going to try and go over that right now. So I'll think about what it is that I want to present on Thursday, but I think mainly it's going to be review, and mainly it's going to be talking about some of those other things and transferring and getting you guys some other good information to work with. Okay. I think that's about it for today. I'm sad. This is like when I start really getting to some of my favorite stuff. These reactions here at the end just get, to be honest, it's all my favorite stuff. I'm always excited. So there's just so much more I want to teach you guys. All right, that's it. I'm going to call it quits. I'm going to be done for today. I'm going to go ahead and stop the recording, and I'll take any questions you guys have. So go ahead and fire away. You're welcome, Jasmine.
Hey, Jason, I had a question about the KOTBU.
Okay.